This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what does the growing political crisis in Baghdad portend for the fight against ISIS and Iraq's stability? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Sparked by followers of prominent Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, the growing political crisis in Baghdad is raising new questions about the extent of U.S. influence over the Iraqi government, considered a critical American ally in the fight against the so-called Islamic State, also known as Daesh. Protesters loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr stormed Baghdad's government seat last Saturday and occupied the Iraqi parliament. Mr. Sadr, the scion of a prominent Shiite clerical family who once led an insurgency against U.S. occupation forces and was responsible for unleashing some of the country's worst sectarian violence, denies he seeks outright power. Instead, he claims to represent the voice of the millions of ordinary Iraqis frustrated by what they see as corruption and inefficiency that have wasted the country's oil wealth in the past 13 years. Sadr claims that he is supporting Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's efforts to curb graft and install competent ministers. The unrest in Baghdad, which is threatening the legitimacy of Iraqi Prime Minister al-Abadi, comes at a particularly bad time, just as American troops are serving closer than ever to the front lines to accelerate the fight against ISIS. An elite U.S. Navy SEAL was killed last week about 3 miles from the front lines north of Mosul after Islamic State fighters penetrated Kurdish Peshmerga forces. It was the third U.S. combat death in Iraq linked to the fight against the Islamic State. And in Syria, a partial truce has been extended to the divided city of Aleppo, according to officials from the United States, Russia, and Syria, after days of diplomacy by American and Russian envoys to halt catastrophic fighting there. Aleppo, which is the main hub of northern Syria, is a crucial battleground split between government-controlled and insurgent-held territory. Nearly 300 people, mostly civilians, have died in renewed fighting there, with government airstrikes pummeling the rebel section, targeting hospitals and civilians. A government strike on a hospital last week killed 50 people, as well as the last remaining pediatrician in the city. The regime of Bashar al-Assad, backed by Russia and Iran, says the Aleppo airstrikes target only al-Nusra, which is affiliated to al-Qaeda and is excluded from the cessation of hostilities along with the rival Islamic State group. The crux of the problem is that the Nusra Front fighters are intermingled with rebel groups and civilians in parts of the insurgent-held territory, which provides the Russian and Iranian-backed Syrian regime the pretext they need to attack. In addition, it is well known that both the Syrian regime and Moscow are very hostile to the U.S.-backed rebel groups and have no compunction about attacking them with or without a cessation of hostilities. In any case, many analysts say the cessation of hostilities don't amount to much more than tactical pauses between the belligerents. For more on the implications of the political crisis in Iraq and the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Nuseiba Yunus is resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a think tank based here in Washington. Her forthcoming book, Invasion to ISIS, Iraq, State Weakness, and Foreign Policy, is due to be published later this year. And Graham Bannerman. He is a former staffer for Middle East and South Asia on the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as well as a former Middle East analyst at the U.S. Department of State Policy Planning Staff. He's currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group also based here in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both. Well, let me begin with you, Nuseiba Yunus. I know you've been traveling frequently to Iraq. Who is responsible, in your view, for this breakdown of authority?
I actually would really put the blame on the heads of the political blocs who have really guided parliamentarians to stymie repeated attempts at reforming the corrupt and broken Iraqi political system on behalf of Prime Minister Abadi. Prime Minister Abadi came to power with an ambitious reform agenda initially that reform agenda was targeted at addressing the often articulated grievances put forward by Iraq's Sunni community. You know, his cabinet put forward reforms of the de-Ba'athification law and proposed an amnesty law and looked at addressing the problem of indiscriminate arrests of young Sunni men. These are some of the things that are long believed to have helped to fuel the rise of ISIS. And, you know, these pieces of legislation went to Parliament to die because parliamentarians would absolutely refuse to really properly deal with this legislation and to pass these reforms.
And both Shia and Sunni parliamentarians.
Yes, both Shia and Sunni.
For various,
all in the pursuit of their own particular political self-interest. And we've seen a repeat of that same behaviour when Prime Minister Abadi has tried to respond to popular protests, which ultimately have been going on intermittently since last summer. We saw huge protests, hundreds of thousands out on the streets last summer when we had searing heats and the electricity service was not able to allow people access to air conditioning and other services. And so Abadi, in response to these protests, came up with another reform agenda. You know, he wanted to slash the costs of public sector workers. He wanted to draw down the number of people in the cabinet and to slash some of the costly ministries and that kind of thing. And once again, Parliament was absolutely unwilling to sanction his reform plans. And what we're seeing now is a Prime Minister who is trying to respond to the demands of the people by trying to implement reforms, and a parliament that is so ingrained, so entrenched in a system that's corrupt and ineffective, but ultimately that they have benefited from, those people are standing in the way of any reform actually being achieved.
Graham Bannerman, as I turn to you, I think of our own government here in the United States, some of the same sort of attitudes. And kidding aside, how do you see who is primarily responsible for this breakdown in authority? Why have the parliamentarians been so resistant to the, one could argue, very good faith efforts on the part of Prime Minister Al-Abadi to try to institute reforms that could benefit the entire country?
I think, from my perspective, the problem is deeper than just corruption and incompetence of the government. I think there's a fundamental lack of a center in Iraq today, of a common identity among the people of Iraq. This is the 100th anniversary of Sykes-Picot, and there was an experiment of creating Iraq, Syria, Jordan. And the idea was these would be nation states. And I think there was an Iraqi identity that did develop and did flourish in the 1960s and 70s. And so when you had the war begin with Iran in 1981, the overwhelming majority of Iraqis identified with Iraq and fought for Iraq. Well, we here in Washington, I can tell you very honestly, we debated whether or not they were going to be Iraqis first or Shia first, and they turned out to be Iraqis first. But I think in the decades since then, that has eroded, and that common identity that holds the country together is no longer there for most Iraqis. That doesn't mean that all Iraqis are that way. That doesn't mean the prime minister is not working to try to achieve this. But right now, there is no common identity and trust that bind the Iraqi people together. So whatever government's there is going to have difficulty holding this country together and making it function as a nation state.
Turning back to you, Nuseiba Yunus, you're certainly free to respond to what Graham Bannerman said. But let's also go to Muqtada al-Sadr, who has been spearheading these recent protests. Remind us about who he is and why is he the one galvanizing these protests?
The really interesting thing about these protests is that actually they're really responding to grievances that cut across sectarian boundaries. There are no Iraqis who do not want to see better electricity provision and better sewage services and sanitation and a healthier and stronger education and healthcare system. You know, the kinds of reforms that these protesters are calling for actually have a real opportunity to finally start to produce an Iraqi political system in which politicians are forced to actually argue on the basis of the issues that citizens care about, rather than constantly going back to identity issues and asking people simply to vote on the basis of their sect. You know, I think we have an opportunity, and Muqtada al-Sadr, he's a very complicated person with a checkered history. He's the descendant of a very powerful and influential Shiite family. He's seen as the least respected and least educated, certainly, of his family. But his name, his popular speaking style, but also his ability to really reflect the mood of the people has made him a very, very influential figure. And one of the really interesting things about the situation we see today is that Muqtada al-Sadr, although his group has in the past been responsible for sectarian killings, today he's making a very deliberate attempt to reach beyond the Shiite sect and to directly to appeal to Sunnis as fellow citizens of the Iraqi state and to say to them, let's come together against this corrupt and broken political institution and let's fight for a better Iraqi politics for all of us. And you'll be astonished by the number of Iraqi Sunnis that I talk to who have nothing but good things to say about Sadr's political agenda. Now, I think, you know, we have to be cautious about whether Sadr really is the right person to really lead this change. But I think certainly if we have other up-and-coming politicians who are willing to form a new political party to fight the next parliamentary elections on the basis of these issues, I think that would be a very positive thing for Iraqi politics.
Back to you, Graham Bannerman. Your take on the fact that Muqtada al-Sadr is the one who's leading these protests, at least for now. They obviously penetrated the green zone, and we're at a crisis point, just as that country is trying to fight off the Islamic State, which seems to still control almost one-third of Iraqi territory. So this is a very unfortunate convergence of problems. Do you see a convergence of interests between Muqtada al-Sadr and now Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi? And what are the prospects for overcoming this impasse?
I do think that al-Sadr has been very clever in catching on to an issue that, as Ms. Yunus said, that crosses sectarian lines. It's all of the Iraqi people are tired of what the situation. They see the parliament as corrupt. They see the system as corrupt. Is that enough to unify the Iraqi people in the long run? Because the question is, right now we have a crisis. Nothing is functioning. The government's not functioning. Things aren't going the right way. Corruption's bad. The parliament is seen as totally counterproductive. That can unite the people to a certain extent, but how do you move that to a positive agenda? And they're struggling with that. That's where countries like the United States and friends of Iraq, we have to support those who are trying to move it to a positive agenda. But it's going to be a very, very difficult issue, because when you come to the next parliamentary elections, people often talk working together, except for when it comes down to voting. Then they vote by family, by community, and to protect their interest. And are they prepared to cross that line?
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Nuseiba Yunus, she's senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, and Graham Bannerman, from whom you just heard. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, a think tank also based here in Washington. We're discussing the growing political instability in Iraq and the implications for the fight against ISIL, also known as Daesh. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at @CarolCastielVOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Carlos Renato dos Santos. He's a loyal listener from Brazil. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, back to you, Nuseiba Yunus, talking about where do we go from here, and what about the role of the United States? How important is it? The Obama administration has been wanting to sort of withdraw from the region and was drawn back in because of the rise of ISIS, and now, of course, has so many troops committed, special forces. We did lose a Navy SEAL recently. So at the same time, we're dealing with this political crisis, which needs to be addressed in Iraq. We are at the same time facing ISIS, trying to defeat ISIS. I mean, this is a very bad time. What should the United States be doing differently?
I think it's absolutely crucial that the U.S. realizes that defeating ISIS in Iraq is not just a military problem. We can't focus entirely on what training, how many troops, how many special forces, how many airstrikes. Ultimately, trying to achieve an Iraq that is stable enough to stave off the continuing threat posed by Islamic extremism is all about helping the Iraqis to put together a government that's legitimate and that's responsive to the needs and to the demands of its people. And I think there's no way, as much as we might like to make this much more sanitary and easy and to separate the military side of this campaign from the political side, there's actually no way of achieving long-term success without really engaging at the level of talking to and lobbying individual parliamentarians. That kind of level, we need to be helping Prime Minister Abadi to shore up his position and to win the votes that he needs in Parliament in order to make these changes. And so I don't think it's enough for us just to deal with Prime Minister Abadi, who, sure, he tells us, yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. You know, we tell him to reform and he's trying to reform, but we need to help him to get it done.
Well, speaking of the Iranians, turning back to you, Graham Bannerman, how do you see the suggestion by Nusseibeh Yunus that the United States should be getting more involved politically, talking to parliamentarians, really helping Haider al-Abadi, the man that we helped to put in that position after getting rid of Nouri al-Maliki? And what about the Iranians? Do we have a point of convergence here? Where do they stand vis-a-vis these protests and Prime Minister al-Abadi?
I think the problem is much broader than just Iraq. I don't think you can separate Iraq from all of the problems in the region. And I think this is one of the mistakes we make. I agree totally that there is no military solution to the radical extremism in the region. We could destroy tomorrow the Islamic State and we would not solve our problem. It is something that Muslims are going to have to solve among themselves, particularly the Sunni Muslim leadership. They're going to have to address that issue. It's going to be region-wide, and it's not just Iraq. And also, the struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a real problem for Iraq, because the Saudi obsession with the Iranian threat makes them work against using Iran to a positive extent in Iraq. It makes them not want to work with the government of Iraq because it's Shia. They are regionally important. I think the United States can be more helpful in fostering some of the better regional issues rather than getting into the day-to-day politics of Iraq. I mean, clearly people will listen to us. The United States has some influence. But to be honest, I think there's a very big cloud that hangs over the American role going back to 2003.
Well, indeed. And speaking of Saudis, it's quite apparent that the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 led to what we see today, that is a Shiite-dominated Iraq, which, of course, is anathema to the Saudis and some other Sunni Gulf states. So that leads me to ask you, Nusseibeh Yunus, what about the influence of Iran in Iraq? Are they more influential, would you say, vis-a-vis the Iraqi government than the United States? Do the Iranians and the Americans have the same interests? Or, you know, at what point do they converge and diverge in terms of how they want to see the Iraqi government?
I don't think that Iran and the United States have the same long-term goals in Iraq. I think for the Iranians, their absolute priority is to maintain very significant influence over the Shiite political elite who happen to be running things in Baghdad. And they want to maintain Iraq as a weak and dependent neighbor that can never again pose the kind of military threat against Iran that it was able to pose in the 1980s. And I think that the United States really would prefer a strong, independent Iraqi state that was responsive to the needs of all of its citizens and not just the Shiite side of its population. I think that our regional partners, our Gulf allies, certainly are desperate for the United States to play a stronger and more active role in Iraq, including in Baghdad politics. They believe that the less the United States has been engaged and has been willing to engage, that they have simply ceded ground to Iran. We don't have to say that we cannot defeat Islamic extremism in Iraq without defeating Islamism in the whole world. And ultimately, what fuels Islamist extremism in different countries is often very responsive and very particular to the local grievances, often fueled by poor governance in each specific location.
So what do you say to that, Graham Bannerman? The very radical extremism that we're seeing exhibited by groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda and others is a
symptom of very poor governance. And in this case, in the case of Iraq, not just poor governance and corruption, but governance that excludes the Sunni minority, that doesn't address their grievances, whether through de-Ba'athification or greater integration in the military, in the economy.
I don't think there's any question that those are factors that help the radical extremists build a popular base. But there's an ideology there of an approach to the world that is very different, and that needs to be confronted. There has to be a struggle within Sunni Islam over who and what we are. We can't participate in that as outsiders. We're Americans. The further we get away from it, the better. And so the United States has to be careful, because if the United States intercedes too much, we then become the rallying point for the radical extremists, and they use to build it.
Well, back to you, Nusaybe Yunus. I did bring in Syria in the beginning because I wanted to establish a connection between the growth of Islamic State in Syria as well as Iraq. Of course, we're seeing in Syria another breakdown in cessation of hostilities, the battle over Aleppo. Do you think that ISIS can actually be defeated without weakening the likes of President Bashar al-Assad, who is backed by Russia and Iran? We have these on and off ceasefires and attempts to pursue peace talks in between, but it seems to be more words on paper, in the sense that as long as Bashar al-Assad remains in the picture and is not backing down from staying in power or refusing any kind of transition. So it's like a vicious circle.
I mean, what we're seeing is the defeat of Islamic State is really not the first priority of Bashar al-Assad, of the Russians, even really of any of the regional powers. It's a real problem that what we have seen instead is Russia, Iran, and the regime of Bashar al-Assad have been tactically manipulating the peace talk process in order to press their battlefield advantage in Aleppo. And I think what we've done as the United States is we have forced a process of peace talks at any cost. We are not playing a game of realpolitik here. We are putting all of our cards on the table, and we're saying the only real course of action we're prepared to take here is to come to a negotiated settlement at a peace talk. And we're not really prepared to invest in changing the facts on the ground, in changing the military calculations of any of these different forces who will come together at the peace talks. We're not prepared to really enact any consequences, no matter what the regime of Bashar al-Assad does in Syria. And so what we've done is just to sit there and really be taken advantage of. And we've allowed the Syrian regime to use the legitimacy of the peace talks as a cover, essentially continuing to press their own tactical short-term advantages on the ground, which they will use to extract even greater concessions from the peace talks.
Turning to you quickly, Graham Bannerman, for anything to add or subtract to what Nusaybe was saying with respect to the Syrian situation. We have a political transition on paper, peace talks, but it seems like the United States is not really helping on the ground, and only changing the calculus on the ground would persuade the likes of a Bashar al-Assad backed by Russia and Iran to really stop the attacks on the civilians and the rebel opposition.
Well, I think there's been attacks on civilians and rebel people on all sides. It's been a horrible civil war. Tens and thousands of people have been killed needlessly. That said, I think the question of those who oppose the Syrian government is, where is international law? How are we going to do this? What is the consequence of that? And how do you weigh that against American values? And it's a very difficult question. It's not really as simple as people make it out to be.
No, it's not a simple question, but some could ask the same question, which is, not doing it shows a lack of implementing or enforcing American values, because people are dying by the day, being attacked by a so-called sovereign government. Again, this is not to excuse any violence from any quarters. It's a very difficult conundrum, and it looks like it's going to last through the next administration, Nusaybe, whatever that will be here in the United States.
I think the next administration could really benefit from sitting down in its first few months in office and looking at the strategy and the tactics that the Obama administration has deployed when it's come to tackling ISIS in both Iraq and in Syria, and to really do an honest assessment of how successful those strategies have been.
That's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Nusaybe Yunus, she's resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, and Graham Bannerman, he's a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Sidrak Franklin, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.